Okay, any questions, comments, reactions before I move on? You know, now, so far, I've been talking about sexual abuse as though the person remembers what happened and all we have to do is ask them and they tell us about it and we know what we need to know. But wait a minute. Aren't a lot of sexual abuse experiences, particularly childhood ones, repressed and the person doesn't remember it and we have to figure out how to recover the memories? And certainly a lot of people in the sexual abuse field would argue that memories of abuse are often repressed, and what we need to do in therapy is uncover repressed memories.
I'm sorry, what? Uncover?
Uncover the repressed memories. And that sounds reasonable. Now, when therapists work to uncover repressed memories, they often have the person telling them about stuff they remember. And sometimes those memories are then corroborated by others, and we've got reason to believe they're accurate. Other times, the accused perpetrator is saying, no way, that never happened, I never did it, this therapist has implanted fake memories. Now, if they really are a perpetrator, they might well claim that this is all fake rather than acknowledging that what happened happened. I mean, we've got a president who does that sort of thing all the time. Or it could be we've got somebody who's innocent who's, you know, facing bogus accusations, and it's hard to defend yourself against something that allegedly happened 20, 30 years ago. How are we going to deal with this? You know, are there repressed memories we need to uncover? Do we need to be careful not to implant false memories? This is an area that gets fairly complex and where there's been lots of controversy and various experts taking extreme stances of various sorts. Trying to stick as closely as possible to reality. There is good reason to believe that sometimes people don't remember stuff that happened or don't remember portions of stuff that happened. Actually, as Barb, I often don't remember stuff that happened. I happen to be quite absent-minded. If something really upsetting happened, one way people sometimes deal with that is by trying to forget about it, trying to pretend it never happened, trying not to remember it. You know, we could debate as to whether the person actually doesn't remember or whether it's that they won't admit remembering. But certainly, it's not at all unusual for people to go through periods where they say they don't remember and it appears that they don't remember. An assortment of studies have tried to look at this, and it seems like somewhere between 20 and 60% of victims of childhood sexual abuse have had periods of time during which they don't remember, either don't remember it at all or don't remember important aspects of it. And this also applies for other traumatic experiences. And, you know, in one study, 30% of the sample reported a period of at least a year long during which they didn't remember the event at all. And this is in cases where we can document that the event actually happened. Does this mean we need to try to guess who's got repressed memories and uncover the repressed memories? Well, one problem is how the heck, if somebody doesn't remember anything happening, how do you know that this is the person where we need to uncover stuff versus this person where nothing happens, so there's nothing we need to uncover? And when I got my degree, nobody gave me magical powers to know who's got repressed memories and who doesn't. One approach that has been pretty common in the sexual abuse field is to decide that certain things are signs that repressed memories are there. And this proves that we need to uncover the repressed memories. You know, if there are reliable, valid indications that in the repressed memory exists, trying to uncover it would make lots of sense. But let's take a concrete example. You know, I had one client, a woman in her late 20s, bright, verbal, successful, anxious, depressed. And one of the things she noticed as we were working on her panic disorder and so on, she went to her aerobics class one day. And in her aerobics class, they had everybody doing one exercise where you're flat on your back, bicycling with your legs, and doing something else with your arms. And All of a sudden, she got really anxious and uncomfortable and felt trapped and vulnerable. She'd read enough pop psych books, so it seemed to her that this was a sign that she must have a repressed memory of sexual abuse. And she came into me in a session and said, "Oh my God, Doc, I must have been sexually abused." She still had no memory of anything happening. But from what she'd read and heard on Oprah and so on, this seemed to her like the sign that she must have a repressed memory. Yeah. Now, we spent some time, reviewing her childhood, reviewing the cast of characters in her childhood. Was there anything else that would fit with the idea that she'd been sexually abused and didn't remember it, etc.? And we came up with a total blank. We got two possibilities. One is, maybe she was indeed sexually abused, repressed it, and I wasn't successful in uncovering it. That's definitely possible. Another definite possibility is this was a false alarm. And, she's read too much pop psych and actually was just freaking out because of her panic disorder. And that's a definite possibility, too. And one thing that's important to notice is, do I have any magical powers to know which fits the situation? No. And if I just automatically say, aha, this person must have repressed memories, and dig and dig and dig and dig and dig and don't stop until I get repressed memories, then I run the risk of digging up repressed memories whether or not they're really there. Either because the client is trying to please me, or because the client wants me to shut up and leave them alone, and this is the only way they can get me to do that. Or because we come up with stuff that sounds reasonable, it makes sense to them, and seems to them to be convincing evidence, even though they don't actually remember anything. Interesting phenomenon that springs to mind is back when I was in grad school, a mailing went out, I think, to basically every mental health professional in the country, educating mental health professionals about alien abductions. And that if you have a client who comes in complaining of having been abducted by aliens, they're not crazy. Here's how you tell if somebody really has been abducted by aliens. And they had this checklist to go down. And I went down the checklist. And one was unexplained bruises. Another was having brief periods of time where you don't remember what happened. I don't have the checklist memorized. And, according to that checklist, I clear the criterion. I've been abducted by aliens. I've got unexplained bruises all the time. Part of that comes from one of my hobbies is fencing, so I'm getting poked by swords on a regular basis. That's a good source of bruises. I also happen to be reasonably clumsy, and I trip over stuff and so on. But then I don't, keep a running inventory of everything I've bumped into and tripped over. So, as Barb, I often have bruises, and maybe that was from fencing, maybe it wasn't. I don't usually have blocks of time where I don't remember what happened, but, when I was in college, one summer I volunteered with a church youth group. We took a bunch of kids to the beach, had a wonderful time, drove back really late at night in a really pea soup fog, and I drove just fine. I got us home safely, but when I got to the church parking lot, I realized, wait a minute, I have no recollection of that whole drive. And it was because I was so focused on the road ahead of me. The stuff wasn't getting transferred from short-term memory to long-term memory. Because nothing noteworthy happened. I didn't have any accidents. I didn't run into anybody. It was just driving through the fog. But I had absolutely no memory of what happened. Okay. And if you take things that it seems plausible, if you've got gaps in your memory and you've got unexplained bruises, this could be because you've been abducted by aliens. But it doesn't prove anything. And exploring and exploring and exploring until you get confirmation is not a way to get to the truth. It could easily work as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And one of the things that adds fuel to debate is, from memory research, we have good reason to believe that if the conditions are right, it is indeed possible to implant false memories. You know, when we remember something, it feels to us like we're playing back a videotape and remembering exactly what happened. But that's actually not the way human memory works. Human memory is reconstructive. Our brain files away certain details, and then when we remember, we fill in the blanks. You know, and how things are handled can distort how we fill in the blanks. For example, let's imagine I show you a bunch of little drawings on cards, tell you to remember these, and then check back tomorrow to see how many of them you remember. Perfectly ordinary memory test. One of the drawings is two circles with a line in between. And with half of you, I label that eyeglasses. And with the other half of you, I label that barbells. The next day when you remember it, those of you who saw it labeled eyeglasses are likely to draw two circles with a bar between and earpieces going back. And the half of you who saw it with the label barbells are going to just draw two circles with alignment in between. But maybe with ovals and a dot, so it looks like discs on a bar rather than two circles connected by a line. And all of you will swear you're remembering the card I showed you yesterday. One study that was done, Elizabeth Loftus has done a bunch of this research. She took a group of college student volunteers and, interviewed them about experiences in their childhood. And by being careful about what questions she asked and how she asked them, she got a fair number of her college students to, quote, remember a time when, as a little kid, they went to the mall and got separated from their parents and got lost and were scared and sad, and a nice little old lady found them and took them back to their parents. When this was an event that hadn't actually happened to them. And so it gets complex. It seems pretty clear that there are times when people don't remember important stuff, and it might be important to find out what happened. It also seems important, clear, that there's some degree of risk of getting people to feel like they're remembering things that didn't actually happen. So what the heck are we supposed to do? Well, actually, we got some decent guidelines on page 4 in the handouts. This is stolen in part from the Australian Psychological Society. And it's important to remember that we don't have magical powers, and that when we run into a situation where it seems like there might be something important the person's not remembering, that may or may not be true. And if we get the person to tell us what happened in their childhood, we may or may not be getting facts. For example, I've got a clear memory from when I was a kid of our family on a long drive going down to Key West through a glass tunnel where you could look out to the side and see whales swim past. This clearly did not happen because that tunnel does not exist. There never has been. It's handy because this is a clearly impossible memory. What happened there? Well, my family did indeed drive down to Key West. And on the way, we stopped at SeaWorld. And at SeaWorld, there were glass windows where you could see dolphins swimming past. And I'm pretty confident that then, a while after that, I had a dream during which, we were driving through the tunnel and seeing whales swim past. But I remembered the dream as though it was an experience, not a dream. And so we don't want to presume, even if there are things that concern us, even if there are things that make it seem like there might be repressed memories, we don't want to presume there are and push and push and push and push and push until the client makes something up. But we don't want to go to the other extreme and figure if they don't remember that there's nothing there. You know, we've got both are possible. And we want to, A, try to approach things in an unbiased way. Just the week before last, I had a client come in wondering, gee, could I have been sexually abused when I was a kid, have this vague sense that something traumatic happened, but I don't remember anything. What did I do? I said, oh, well, sounds like something important for us to talk about. You know, what have you been feeling? What have you been thinking? You know, do you see anything that gives you reason to believe that this is a legit feeling? I mean, that this feeling is a legit sign that there's something traumatic happened that you don't remember. You know, do you, from what you do remember, you know, anything that would fit that with the idea that you were sexually abused? What do you think of, you know, simply being willing to remember and paying attention to what memories come up, and we'll see what comes up. And we also discuss some of the possibilities. It could be some sexual abuse happened and she has not been willing to remember it and therefore hasn't remembered it. Now, it's possible, you know, this is a bogus feeling that came up for some reason. Another idea I put in the hopper, it's possible something upsetting happened to her as a kid. That wasn't actually sexual abuse. If you think about it, when you're a kid, all sorts of stuff can be real upsetting. You know, if I'm a little kid going to the bathroom and somebody walks in on me, some kids are going to find that really upsetting and traumatic, and this is not sexual abuse. This is somebody walking in on me by accident, etc. And she came back the next week saying, yeah, she hadn't remembered anything, but this feeling wasn't bothering her anymore. And seems to her that the idea that maybe something that was upsetting to her as a little kid happened, you know, makes a lot of sense. Now, I have no way of knowing whether it was a false alarm, no sexual abuse, or whether there was sexual abuse she's not remembering. And I need to be aware of my limitations. But if it's not a problem, we probably don't need to explore it further. You know, the good old rule, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, if somebody is having day-to-day problems that seem linked to some traumatic experience in their past, it probably makes sense to try to figure out what the heck happened, particularly if we can do it in a way that doesn't bias it, doesn't distort. If the person's doing okay, then we don't need to uncover all their past traumas. And actually, one thing to keep in mind is it's not necessarily doing the person a favor to uncover traumatic experiences if they're not causing problems in the here and now. You know, because if you spend a block of time remembering all the various traumas you had earlier in your life, it runs the risk of having you more upset in the here and now, having more difficulties in the here and now. How's all that sound?
I was just going to elaborate on a little bit that you said.
Mm-hmm.
When you said, I had counseled a young lady, and her mother actually brought her in because she thought she was being sexually abused by her stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out, the little girl, after I talked to her, it took me a minute, but come to find out, the little girl woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning and heard her mother and father having an intimate moment and actually put that into her own,
mm-hmm,
as if it was her.
Yeah.
And told us, after she told the story, I figured out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the mom was so adamant that this her daughter was being sexually abused, and come to find out, she made it was bizarre how she,
mm-hmm,
put herself in there. It was crazy, but
yeah,
she ended up not being sexually, mm-hmm, abused.
Yeah, and you know, one thing to keep in mind is stuff looks different to kids than it does to adults, and they may well misinterpret, misunderstand, and so on. Also, if I wake up in the middle of the night and whatever's going on, you know, I may not yet be fully awake, I may not be firing on all cylinders, and I may misunderstand or misconstrue stuff, you know, by virtue of being awakened in the middle of the night. Yeah. So this gets complex, and it would be great if we had a simple, easy way to tell, you know, which, you know, apparent memories are legit and which are distorted and which are completely bogus. There's no magical way to do that. You know, if other people, you know, if the client's siblings and so on confirmed, yeah, that did happen, then we've got good reason to believe it happened. But often, you know, there's no easy way to check out whether it happened or not. And often, some of the players involved have their own biases. You know, if parents are divorced and mom's really concerned that dad is abusing the kids, this could be because of mom's issues with dad, or it could be because, you know, dad is a high risk for offending. You know, and unless I know the situation well, it's hard to tell, you know, whether mom's suspicions are likely to be well-founded or not. And, you know, if we're dealing with somebody who's been reading a lot of pop psych stuff about sexual abuse, you know, that may stir up lots of concerns and add fuel to the fire. On the what to do front, first of all, you know, we're going to do our usual initial evaluation and talk over goals and priorities. At some point in treatment, if the person does have a history of sexual abuse, at some point we're going to need to find out what happened and what their thoughts and feelings were and what conclusions they drew and so on. Often, we don't want to do that during the initial evaluation, because this is sensitive stuff that's hard for people to talk about. And if I've just met you, and I, okay, what brings you into therapy? Okay, what did your stepfather do when, etc., is way too fast and too abrupt. You know, if somebody walks through the door wanting to tell me about their experience of sexual abuse and ready to do that, great, no problem. But there are many people with a history of sexual abuse where it takes a while for them to get comfortable with me and be ready to talk about it, particularly if this is something that they haven't talked about with other people, they've been really uncomfortable talking about, and so on. For example, with Claire, you know, she told me about her sexual abuse probably a year and a half after I started seeing her. We were working on her major depression and her anxiety issues and her perfectionism. And after she told me about it, it was probably another 6 months before she told me it was her grandfather. Up to that point, it was an unspecified family member. And it takes some judgment to figure out how much do I push and how much do I sit back and let the client tell me at their own pace. And I want to pay attention to nonverbal cues, encourage the client to let me know if it's getting too uncomfortable, etc. Because, you know, if I'm trying to be efficient and get them help promptly, we want to find out what happened and start dealing with it as quickly as is feasible. But rushing doesn't get you there sooner. If I push too fast and the client starts no-showing or drops out of therapy or clams up and won't talk about it, this does not speed things up. You know, if I go to the other extreme and just sit back and wait for the story to unfold, that can take roughly forever. So I need to shoot for something in between the two extremes. And I want to pay, as soon as I have any inkling that sexual abuse is an issue, I want to pay particularly attention to the therapeutic relationship. Things may go just fine and not be an issue, but it wouldn't be at all surprising if developing trust is a little more complex than it is with the average client. If collaboration is a little more complex than it is for the average client. If the client speaking up for what they want and saying no to things they don't want to do is a little more complex than with the average client. If getting the client to take an active role and exercise power in treatment is a little more complex than it is with the average client. And often, if I just pay a little extra attention and gentle, pay attention to pacing and so on, it goes just fine. But if I just ignore it, these things can end up being problems in therapy. You know, also, as soon as I have at least a vague sense of what actually happened, I want to be careful not to recapitulate that experience in my interactions with the client. You know, now in general, if I'm being collaborative, you know, and getting the client's input, then we're, et cetera, you know, this isn't going to happen a whole lot in CPT. But you never know when something coincidental will come up. A good concrete example, it doesn't actually have anything to do with a history of sexual abuse, if I remember this client right. But my first client in my first practicum in grad school turned out to be borderline, be a very interesting learning experience. You know, one of the things that happened about 6 or 8 sessions into therapy, she came in one day, obviously really anxious, and said she thought she was going to have to discontinue treatment. It took me totally by surprise. I had no clue, so I didn't know what the heck was going on. Well, she's been getting more and more anxious before each session for no obvious reason. Anxiety's getting so bad she can't tolerate it. She just wanted to say goodbye. It blew me away. I was doing psychodynamic therapy at the time. They hadn't taught us how to deal with this situation yet. And, you know, I was sort of trying to puzzle through, what the heck do I do? When she said, oh my God, it happened. It turned out that what happened was I leaned forward and made direct eye contact. And that raised the level of intimacy higher than she could tolerate and freaked her out. And it was actually real handy that it happened because I had no idea what you do from psychodynamic therapy. I had to rely on common sense. Hey, if leaning forward and making eye contact freaks her out, maybe I should try not to do that. So I said, oh, well, I'll try not to do that. And it occurred to me, you know, I'm not constantly self-monitoring. I can't guarantee I won't lean forward and make eye contact. So then I followed up with, would you be willing to let me know? I'll try not to do that, but would you be willing to let me know if I do it? And then I'll back off. And, you know, A, this is useful feedback from the client. B, it gives her some control in the situation, which makes it easier to tolerate. I followed up with, and would you let me know if I do anything else that makes therapy uncomfortable for you? You know, do you have any other ideas what we could do to make things more comfortable? She didn't. How about if we move the chairs farther apart? Sounded reasonable to her. We tried it. That did indeed make it more comfortable. And we were able to muddle through and keep working together. And even though I was doing psychodynamic therapy, it ended up going real well. She finished her master's before I finished mine. And, you know, while in her case, she didn't have a history of sexual abuse as far as I know. She had other intimacy issues. There's no shortage of people with a history of sexual abuse where leaning forward and making eye contact is going to freak them out. Now, as soon as I realize that's an issue for them, I can try not to do it. I can get their feedback, etc., and hopefully handle it so that it doesn't muck up their life. In addition to, you know, doing my best not to, you know, do anything that's going to trigger unfortunate reactions in the client, I also want to keep my eyes open for misinterpretations and clear things up as quickly as possible. Because even if I'm on my best behavior and do things perfectly fine and I'm being collaborative and I'm respecting their limits and so on, there's no guarantee that there won't be some misinterpretations and misunderstandings. This is one of the places where paying attention to the nonverbal cues and so on can be really valuable. If things are going fine and then all of a sudden the person shifts to a closed posture and is no longer responding as freely to my comments and questions, okay, something happened here. What's going on? You seem a lot less comfortable now than you were a few minutes ago. And we can work together to understand how are they feeling, what thoughts are running through their head, was there something I said or did? And the odds are good that we'll be able to figure it out and clear it up. If I ignore it, then it's going to muck up the rest of the session, and it may have an impact on whether they come back next time or not. When the person is ready to talk about the abuse, obviously I want to find out what happened, what led up to it, thoughts, feelings, what impact it's had in their life. I also want to get a picture of how things were going before the abuse. That may be real useful in understanding what impact the abuse had in the client's life. Also, it will help me sort out whether the problems they're having currently are an effect of the abuse or were ongoing problems before. The client's got a big-time fear of thunderstorms as a problem for them, and this wasn't a problem before the abuse, and it started up right after the abuse. Hey, sounds like in some way it's a side effect of the abuse. If they had a fear of thunderstorms way before the abuse happened, this is not an effect of the abuse. It's an independent problem. It may have been aggravated by the abuse, or it may just be a freestanding separate problem. And in addition to finding about the client's thoughts and feelings and conclusions, I'm also going to want to find out how the people around them reacted to it. If they told their parents about the abuse, if they reported the abuse, then we've got the opportunity to find out how people actually did react. If this is somebody who was sexually abused and kept it to themselves, then it's useful to find out, do they remember what their image was of how people would react? Our usual approach of focusing on problem situations one at a time and walking through what led up to it, what happened, what were the thoughts and feelings, what did they say and do, how did that turn out, still turns out to be a real good idea. I want to strike a balance. As we're looking at problem situations, I want to keep my eyes open for ways in which what's going on in the moment connects back to their sexual abuse. But I don't want to presume that everything ties into the sexual abuse. Just because a person's had an unfortunate experience does not mean everything in their life relates to that. How's all that sound? Any questions at this point? Yeah.
So if they remember a memory and they're not sure if that's true, mm-hmm. or it was their dream, and mm-hmm. they say it, I have a memory, but I'm really not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that it happened, but it might be a dream. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How would you take it?
Well, there are a couple pieces to it. One is, this is a good time for examining the evidence. What do they see that would convince them that this actually happened? What do they see that doesn't fit with the idea that this actually happened? What do they see that fits with the idea that this might have been a dream? What do they see that doesn't fit with the... And sometimes there are details that when they think it through systematically, is pretty convincing. Wait a minute. I remember my older brother being there, but he died when I was 8. He couldn't have been there. Okay, we've got good reason to believe that that doesn't really hold water. And sometimes, now then we think about, actually, I remember this, and this is starting to hang together, it's starting to make sense. Another thing is, is there any way we can cooperate? If they remember, their sibling being there, is their sibling still alive? Could they go ask them and find out if their sister remembers the same thing happening or not? Sometimes we've got the opportunity to check out whether it really happened the way they remembered or not. Often we don't have that option. Also, if they check with their sibling and their sibling remembers it differently than they do, this doesn't prove it that it happened. I can think of a whole list of things that my brother remembers differently than I do. This is a very common experience. Actually, I've worked with lots of couples where I would really love a little drone with a video camera to follow them around at home. The two people have such different stories about what actually happened in real life. It would be real interesting to know if either of these resembles the truth in any way. But so, yeah, it can be complex. But, you know, trying to look at it realistically in an unbiased way, you know, is one thing that's useful. Also, do we need to know what actually happened? You know, if we can be clear what the emotional impact was, you know, I'm not sure if it actually happened or not, but ever since then I have not been willing to trust strangers. Well, the person's not willing to trust strangers, and we can take a look at, okay, in situations where they're not willing to trust strangers, what's the situation, what led up to it, what are the thoughts and feelings, etc. And then we can look at the pros and cons of not trusting strangers and the pros and cons of sometimes choosing to trust strangers, etc. And we may well be able to address what needs to be addressed without having to find out what's historically accurate.
So if you have a client who had some of this sexual abuse happen in the past, but the client worked whatever way, as you are working with the problem that right now client mm-hmm. is experiencing, you do see a little bit, maybe there was some impact, but the client doesn't want to work on mm-hmm. the past sexual yeah. abuse. She's kind of like, yeah, I know it happened, it's what they can do about it, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Would you insist on working on that?
Because well, you see some impact. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to insist on anything because I'm trying to maintain a collaborative relationship. And it can be real tempting sometimes, so that's something to keep in mind. One of the things I'm generally going to do, whether or not sexual abuse is involved, is in the first round, I'm going to try dealing with the client's problems in the here and now without going back into history a whole lot. And if we can deal with it effectively in the here and now, and we solve the problem and the problem stays solved, we've discovered we don't need to spend time on whatever experience has led up to this. You know, if we try working on it in the here and now and we can't solve the problem in the here and now, or the problem doesn't stay solved, then we've got good reason to believe that we need to go into the past to some extent. And what we try to do is go into the past selectively and concisely. So rather than spending months rehashing the person's whole childhood, we focus on the bits and pieces that have had lasting impact. You know, and that's what we would generally do. Now, if the person doesn't want to go into the past, I would start by finding out what don't they like about the idea of going into the past. You know, and maybe look at the pros and cons of discussing, you know, the experience they had and how it relates to their current problems. And the pros and cons of trying to deal with it without discussing what happened. And often it turns out that the main issue is, you know, if we talk about what happened, it will be upsetting. Which sounds like a legit reason to not do it unless it's necessary. On the other hand, if it turns out we can't solve this problem without discussing the past to some extent, then it sounds like they've got a choice. We can discuss the past and they can put up with being upset in the short run in the hope of coming up with a solution to the problem. Or we can not do that and they can keep having this problem and they get to choose. You know, they're hiring me, I'm not in charge of their life. And if somebody really wants to keep having the same problem, they've got the right to do that. You know, however, it may well be to their advantage to do it and put up with some upsetting feelings, some upsetting memories, long enough for us to address it and resolve it. And this may be a useful time to help them think through the advantages and disadvantages of avoiding unpleasant feelings. You know, which gets into the topic of what in technical terms we label experiential avoidance. You know, with anxiety disorders, we talked about avoidance mostly in terms of avoiding phobic situations. But if you think about it, we also talked about people avoiding certain physiological, oh my God, my heart's racing, I better do things so that my heart doesn't race, etc. People don't just avoid situations, they avoid certain experiences. And with anxiety disorders, a lot of people avoid feeling anxious. And we talked about the value of, you know, being willing to face anxiety and tolerate anxiety and discover that it's just unpleasant, it's not dangerous, etc. Well, it turns out there's a whole host of other feelings people avoid. Barb's going to be talking about grief this afternoon. Gee, do people ever avoid sadness? Well, I'll let her talk about it this afternoon.
Yeah.
If I feel ashamed about something,
you know,
A, I'm probably going to do my damnedest not to tell other people about it, but also, I may do my best to avoid thinking about it. Because if I think about it, I feel shame in this here and now. And if I avoid thinking about it, I avoid feeling shame in the here and now, but I also don't have a chance to think it through and figure out, is this really as shameful a thing as it feels like it is? And some people go for decades with terrible shame over stuff that's not actually a big deal. Or suppose I did something in the past that I feel guilty about. If I let myself think about it, I feel guilty. If I don't let myself think about it, I don't feel guilty, but I don't have a chance to think through, wait a minute, did I really value, violate an important moral principle? Is this really a good way to deal with my transgression? And I have plenty of clients where it turns out, wait a minute, I spent decades feeling guilty about something that was actually not a big deal. Or I spent decades punishing myself over something when punishing myself is not a very effective way to get myself to do better in the future. It would work better to learn from the experience and try not to repeat my mistakes. And so, you know, in general, you know, there are a lot of different problems where part of what perpetuates the problems is a person avoiding certain feelings, avoiding certain memories, avoiding thinking about certain topics. And it's often useful to help people think through, wait a minute, is it really, yes, it will be upsetting, unpleasant to, you know, think about this or talk about this or tell my therapist about this. Would it be a good idea to go ahead and put up with those feelings so that I can deal with stuff that needs to be dealt with and get to the point where this is not a problem for me anymore? And so, you know, that might well be a good occasion for that discussion. And I'm hoping to have time to do a little writing about experiential avoidance in the foreseeable future. So there may well be something on our Facebook page in a few weeks if I ever have any spare time. In terms of, you know, when we get to intervening, you know, obviously one level of intervention is the straightforward identifying the dysfunctional thoughts and coming up with adaptive alternatives, you know, identifying dysfunctional beliefs, coming up with adaptive alternatives, and then putting them into practice in real life via behavioral experiments. And that's real useful stuff, and we do a ton of it. There also are some things that, you know, go beyond that, that I find real useful. And I'm going to just hit on a number of those. Well, first of all, you know, some people with a history of sexual abuse have PTSD, and some don't. You know, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time today discussing the treatment of PTSD because we covered that a few months ago. But in the handout, for those who want more detail on treating PTSD, I've got on pages 5 and 6, I've got, you know, brief summaries of three different CBT approaches to treating PTSD. I've got prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive processing therapy, and trauma-focused CBT. And then in the recommended resources at the front of the handouts, I've got some websites that you can go to for more detail. And then at the top of page 7, I've got repeated Falsetti's recommendations about treating PTSD, which I talked about back when we were on PTSD. That's all just to refresh your memory on that front, and I'm happy to field questions about PTSD. One thing that comes up a lot with sexual abuse is self-blame, guilt, and shame. And, you know, a lot of kids who are sexually abused have this vague sense that sex is bad. I did something sexual, I must be a bad person. You know, and this is just sort of a kid level of making sense of what happened. And particularly in the course of normal development, kids go through several stages where they tend to take things egocentrically. They tend to blame themselves for whatever happens. If grandma dies, it feels like it must have been because of something I said or did. Not because I killed grandma, but because developmentally, I'm inclined to blame myself for whatever happens. If the adults around me tend to blame me for whatever happens and tend to blame me when they're upset about other shit and they're just making it out on me, that increases the likelihood of me blaming myself. And often, people who've been sexually abused put lots of time and energy into beating themselves up over it, telling themselves how horrible they are, how bad they are, how disgusting they are, etc. And one of the things we want to do is get them to quit doing that already, because it's making them, they're making themselves miserable without it doing any damn good. And there are a couple different things that are useful. One is, once we have identified this pattern of persistently, you know, criticizing themselves, blaming themselves, telling themselves how horrible they are, one thing that's useful is to take us back, gee, you've been doing all this stuff. We get concrete examples. What's the point to that? What are you hoping to accomplish? And this is often something the person hasn't thought about. And sometimes, you know, they can make a connection. Well, I was bad. I should be punished. Nobody else is punishing me. I better punish myself. You know. Or, this was wrong. I don't want to do that again. I don't want it to happen again. Therefore, I better give myself hell over it. You know, and a lot of this is not terribly thought through. But if you think about it, you know, when a kid's growing up, if they do something bad, how do the adults around them react? Criticism, blame, shame, shoulds, etc. And one of the things we learn from that experience is, if somebody's bad, this is the thing to do to make them be good in the future. And so if 30 years later I'm a boss dealing with an employee who shows up late for work, I may well find myself treating the employee the way I was treated as a child, because it seems to me this is what you do to get somebody to do better in the future. If I was bad in some way, or I think I was bad in some way, I may well blame myself, punish myself, criticize myself, because the unspoken assumption is this is what I need to do to get myself to do better in the future. And if we can get that out in the open, then we can help the client look at, how well is that working? Yeah. It is not unreasonable to figure if somebody's been bad, I yell at them, I criticize them, I blame them, this is supposed to get them to do better in the future. How long have you been yelling at yourself, blaming yourself, criticizing yourself? Oh, a few decades now. How well has it worked as a way to get yourself to go forth and do better in the future? Obviously, if it worked well, why are we sitting here talking about it? You know, sometimes it's a strategy that doesn't work and the person's just persisting with it and trying harder and harder. Sometimes the person hasn't registered that they don't have any sense of what's the stopping point, what's enough criticism. You know, it's not that self-criticism is automatically a bad idea. It's not that self-blame is automatically a bad idea. In moderation, it can be useful. Gee, this coat of paint didn't come out very even. I think you better put on a second coat of paint. Nothing wrong with that. I was doing that last weekend. You know. But if I keep criticizing myself, blaming myself indefinitely, no matter how well I'm doing, this gets counterproductive pretty fast. And often people haven't thought through what's enough. Also, when the self-criticism, self-blame, and so on isn't working, people often don't get around to thinking, wait a minute, what else could I do? Are there more promising ways to get myself to turn over a new leaf and do better in the future? And with sexual abuse, often people are blaming themselves for stuff that's not their fault. You know, do I need to criticize myself and blame myself and give myself a hard time to stop Grandpa from abusing me in the future? No, that's not the way it works. A, Grandpa's dead. B, it wasn't my fault. I don't need to give myself help. see, you know, if grandma is still alive, there are more promising ways to keep her from abusing me in the future. And people, particularly with all the shame and guilt, people don't let themselves think this through and register, ooh, what I'm doing is a dumb idea. There are more promising ways to deal with it. So by in manageable steps, helping the person face stuff they've been avoiding, think it through, and do it in concrete steps, we can greatly facilitate people coming, getting perspective, you know, coming up with more adaptive approaches. One thing that's real useful in helping people stop being so hard on themselves is imagine some other little kid who was abused by their grandpa from the ages of 5 to 12. What would you say to her? Would you say to this kid, you're horrible, you're disgusting, nobody's going to want you anymore, etc., etc.? No. You know, Claire actually taught preschool for a while. She likes little kids. She's good with little kids. She's nice and kind and gentle with little kids. What she would say to another kid who'd been sexually abused would be quite reasonable and adaptive and helpful to the kid. Would it be a good idea to say those things to yourself instead of the stuff you've been saying to yourself? A, that was something she hadn't thought of. B, often the client's initial reaction is, they get really anxious. It's an uncomfortable idea. You know, and what's uncomfortable about it? What makes it seem like it's not such a good idea? Would there be any drawbacks? Would there be any repercussions? Often it's just this vague sense that if I've been bad, I should punish myself. Without it being terribly thought through. And often it ties into the person's religious education and upbringing and so on. I don't address religion in therapy a whole lot. That's not really my department. However, when it's an important part of the client's problem, it can be useful to address. And I went through a religious phase earlier in my life, and I can quote scripture with the best of them, and it's handy upon occasion. And so helping the person think through, if they've got this feeling that there's some moral imperative to give themselves help over their past transgressions, if you think of the Ten Commandments, anything in there that says, if you've been bad, you should give yourself hell for the rest of your life. Last time I checked, Moses left that one out. Depending on the client, I will use humor some, but in moderation, and humor can be tricky in therapy, so you need to be tuned in well with the client, you need good judgment, or it's easy for it to feel like you're not taking them seriously. On the other hand, if your timing's good, it can be pretty impactful, And so you probably already know from your own experience whether humor turns out to be a good, bad, or mediocre idea when you try using it. Another thing I often throw in for, Christians who are spending a lot of time giving themselves hell for their past transgressions is, when the woman caught committing adultery was brought in front of Christ, what did he say? Did he say, okay, go forth and feel guilty and punish yourself the rest of your life? No. Did he say, adultery is just fine? No. What he said, according to the reports, is, go forth and sin no more. After throwing in, let him who is without sin cast the first stone, because in those days you were supposed to, if somebody was caught committing adultery, you were supposed to stone them to death. And my take on it is he actually didn't even mean go forth and be perfect from here on out. He meant go forth and see about doing better. And that's about as far as I get into bringing religion into it. But particularly for somebody like Claire, who was brought up with a very observant Catholic background, went through parochial schools, got a big dose of the old school nuns and so on. It was something that needed to be addressed. We've got two options. I could address it myself. Or another real good option is, do I know a religious leader in her denomination who's a reasonable, insightful person who will be helpful with this? And if I happen to know of one, this can be a real valuable resource. back when Barb and I were in grad school, we got a lot of gay Catholic clients who were struggling with their sexuality. This was happened to be a time when the church was going through a lot of struggles with how do you deal with homosexuality. And there were priests in East Lansing who were a really valuable resource, and there were priests in East Lansing who were a really bad idea. And we had enough gay Catholic clients, so we knew which priests to refer our clients to. These days, I don't have nearly as many gay Catholic clients, so I have to start from scratch in figuring out which priests are likely to be a useful resource and which to stay away from. How's all that sound? Another thing that comes up a lot is people look back at what happened and they say, I should have known. You know, I should have done X differently. I should have done Y differently. And they spent a lot of time blaming themselves. There our woman on the videotape was saying, I didn't have to go along with it. I could have said something. Wait, as a 5-year-old kid, as it was happening, did it occur to her, oh, I don't have to go along with this. I could say no. You know, I don't think very many 5-year-old kids dealing with an older brother stop and think, oh, I don't have to go along with this, particularly if they adore their older brother and like the attention and so on. You know, most kids just either do whatever their older siblings tell them or rebel against their older siblings all the time and don't do a whole lot of thinking about it. You know, I could have said something. Wait, is it 5-year-old behavior to say, wait a minute, this is a bad idea. I'm going to object to it. No, that's adult thinking. That's not 5-year-old thinking. And so, you know, in the, you know, video, Pat did a little bit of helping her think back how it looked to her as a kid and floating the idea, is it fair to judge myself by adult standards when I was a 5-year-old kid dealing with it? And with this client, that seemed to work fine as a way of dealing with it and something that Pat would have been doing more of later on. At the bottom of page 7, we've got Corey Newman's chi-square technique, a dumb name for a technique. For those of you who don't remember your info stats course, this chi-square technique is a statistical test where you have a 2x2 grid of numbers, and it got called that because it's a 2x2 grid. It's got nothing to do with the statistical test. It's actually a dumb label for the technique that I don't believe that's the label that's used. What is useful about it is looking back at what happened, you know, distinguishing between what, you know, could I have foreseen and what couldn't I foresee? And what could I have done and what did I do? And this can be, breaking it down that way, can be really useful. You know, imagine somebody who's walking down the street late at night, turns a corner, a rapist jumps out of the bushes and rapes them. You know, often the person's later in our office saying, I shouldn't have turned down that street. Wait a minute, at the point where they turned the corner, did they know a rapist was hiding in the bushes? Probably not. You know, had they known there was a rapist in the bushes, would they have turned down that corner? Probably not. But at the point where they turned the corner, they didn't know the rapist was in the bushes. You know, I can buy the idea that if I know there's a rapist in the bushes and I go that way, then it's my own damn fault if they hop out of the bushes and get me. But I seriously doubt if that ever happens. Often people put a lot of time and energy into blaming themselves about stuff that there was no way they could foresee it happening. And they blame themselves for not doing stuff that there was no reason to think they should have done. And helping them think it through step by step is a good way to help them register, wait a minute, I'm not to blame for this. I'm not at fault for this. Now, I don't want to presume the person is absolutely innocent in a way that then makes them feel, if they did use poor judgment about who to go home with, you know, it's completely appropriate for them to accept responsibility for having used poor judgment and regret that and resolve to use better judgment in the future. Does that mean they're at fault for what happened after they used poor judgment? No. Going home with a stranger when I'm drunk is a dumb thing to do. That doesn't make it okay for the stranger to do what they do once they've got me privately when I'm drunk. Two separate issues. You know, just because I use poor judgment does not mean I'm to blame for the other person's inappropriate behavior. On the other hand, using better judgment in the future sounds like a pretty good move. For kids who've been sexually abused, paying attention to, are they drawing a distinction between being the victim and the perpetrator? And if they're not, helping them draw that distinction can be really useful. A lot of kids, you know, particularly if they're pretty young when they're abused, you know, react as though they're one of the perpetrators, and that's not at all what's going on. Now, they just don't draw that distinction. One of the long-term repercussions of a history of sexual abuse could be low self-esteem, low worth, etc. And helping the person think through, you know, does what happened to me wipe out all of my good points and validate all of my good points can be really useful. Now, if part of what's going on is the person hasn't let anybody know about what happened to them, and they're thinking, if people only knew, they wouldn't like me, they wouldn't appreciate me, they wouldn't see me as worthwhile, etc. Then we've got a situation where at some point it might be really valuable for them to choose to let some people know. Now, we get the choice of who and when and how. One possibility is them letting me know and me responding both verbally and non-verbally in ways that makes it clear that I still value and respect and care and so on. That may be enough. You know, telling one person who can accept what happened to them and still see them as a worthwhile person may be sufficient. It also might well be valuable to have it be more than one person, because for some people, it's, well, you're a therapist, you're paid to like me, you're paid to care about me, that doesn't count. Now, this doesn't mean it's a good idea to broadcast it on the public address system, and I may want to help the person choose who, if anybody, they want to share this with. There may be people in their life they care about and are close to who would be real good candidates. Or a support group can be really valuable. One of the really cool things about a support group is if I'm in a group with a bunch of other people who've been sexually abused, and they're actually nice, worthwhile people with plenty of good points, and I would like them just fine and want to be their friend if I met them in the outside world, that makes it easier to register, oh, maybe I'm a nice, okay, worthwhile person that a reasonable person could like and care about too. And so, you know, support groups are definitely a resource worth considering as part of the package. One of the things that comes up a lot is a feeling of vulnerability. And one thing that I find really useful to do when somebody's feeling vulnerable is to clarify, vulnerable to what? What's their image of what might happen? And, you know, and then we want to look at it realistically. You know, we're not going for the opposite extreme. We're not trying to convince the person they're invulnerable. None of us is invulnerable. And actually, one of the challenging things about a lot of traumatic experiences, whether it has to do with sex or other sorts of traumatic experiences, is it can bring home, a lot of us go through life feeling safe and comfortable and secure because we're ignoring unpleasant aspects of reality. And when we have an experience that brings it home that, oh my God, you know, life can change in the drop of a hat, terrible stuff can happen out of the blue, and so on, this is something that a lot of clients have a hard time getting their heads about, and it can be challenging for therapists too, because having our illusions cut through is not a fun thing either. And, you know, with the woman on the tape who's thinking, you know, oh my God, nobody's safe, you can be killed out of the blue at any time. You know, there's a level on which that's true. There was a sniper in D.C. shooting people out of the blue for no reason other than his own pathology. And that's not impossible. This is not good. How do we come to terms with that? How do we make sense of it? Well, one piece of it is, yes, this is something that can conceivably happen. You know, of the people I know, how many are shot out of the blue for no reason? I've been fortunate enough to have a life where that's never happened to anybody I know. That doesn't mean it's impossible, but it does give me a sense of how likely it is. You know, there's other terrible stuff that's more likely. You know, good friend of my, of our daughter's dad, you know, 54 years old, health freak, great shape, nice guy, had a massive coronary, dropped dead at his desk at the Cleveland Clinic. This is not good. It brings mortality home. He was younger than I am. This is not good. People are only supposed to die when they're a lot older than me. And we need to come to terms with that. And one level of it is, you know, I am going to die someday. This is not good, but this is reality. You know, unexpected stuff can happen, and I can't guarantee it won't. Taking good care of oneself improves your odds, but doesn't guarantee eternal life. It's still a good idea. It's still worth doing. It's probably a good idea to keep my health insurance paid up. You know, it's probably a good idea to have life insurance if there are people who are financially dependent on me. You know, it's probably a good idea to go ahead and live a good life while I can, since I don't know for sure how long I've got left. It's also probably a good idea for me to do some long-term financial planning, since both my parents are still alive, even though my mom's 104. So I got to plan for an old, you know, old age, but also, you know, I've come to terms with not having a guarantee that I'll make it that long. And so working with these issues stirs up a lot of deep issues that we need to come to terms with in order to be helpful to our clients. You know, there's a lot of anxiety and avoidance. And to some extent, it's just like dealing with any phobia. We need to face our fears in manageable steps, and voila, we get comfortable with them. But just like with fears and phobias, there's also no shortage of complexities we can run into. You know, Maria, I used it as an example a while back when we were on anxiety disorders. She got really freaked out about the idea of sitting on her front steps and had this image of a car coming around the bend and not making the corner and running over her if she sat on the front steps. You know, well, at some point she's going to need to sit on the front steps and put up with her anxiety and get comfortable on the front steps. But if we try getting her to do that before we address that image of what's going to happen, she's not going to follow through. She's not an idiot, as long as she honestly believes it's dangerous. So we need to think through, okay, what convinces her that this is what will happen if she sits on her front steps? How fast are the cars going when they round that corner? How often do cars, you know, not make it around the corner? How often does a car end up sitting on her front steps? Ah, this is a suburban neighborhood where cars are driving like 35 miles an hour. It's a perfectly ordinary bend in the road. Everybody manages to stay on the road. No car has ever ended up in her front lawn, let alone on her front steps. This is something that's scary but not dangerous. Now we've got a decent shot at getting her to, in manageable steps, sit on the front porch and tolerate the anxiety and get comfortable with the front porch. It gets a little more complex when you're talking about, you know, anxiety about intimacy, anxiety about trust. How do I sort out whether this is dangerous or safe? How do I sort out what risks I'm willing to take, what risks I'm not willing to take? And, you know, we're likely to need to spend some time helping the person think it through step by step. And then, you know, risking trust in manageable steps and tolerating the anxiety and discovering that it's a fine idea to trust at least something. We may need to spend some time in manageable steps, helping the person risk intimacy and tolerate the anxiety and discover that intimacy is not such a bad idea after all. Now, by the point in therapy we're working on this, the odds are that the client has been trusting us quite a bit. and has been risking a fair amount of intimacy in therapy, and it may be that this hasn't freaked them out because they haven't particularly noticed that they're doing it. But if we can help them register, wait a minute, seems like you've been trusting me a fair amount. You know, has that turned out to be a terrible idea, or has that turned out okay? Gee, it seems like you've been revealing stuff to me you don't reveal to other people. How's that been turning out? Is this terribly dangerous, or is this turning out to be okay? You know, can be useful as one of the interim steps. You know, and this is another one where concrete analogies can be useful. You know, one that I remember using with Maria, I don't think I've used this one with Clary yet, but I use it a lot with fear of intimacy. You know, let's imagine we got somebody walking through the woods in a sweatshirt. You know, it's heavy, it's hot, they're sweaty, but why are they wearing the suit of armor? Because it seems necessary, because it seems like if they're not armored, you know, they're going to be attacked, they're going to be injured, etc. And if I walk through the woods in the suit of armor and put up with it being hot and sweaty and bugs getting down my back and so on, and nobody attacks me and nobody shoots me and nobody stabs me, is it that if safe in the woods I don't need the suit of armor? Or is it that nobody's attacking me because they can see I've got a suit of armor on? And as long as I go through life wearing my suit of armor, I don't discover whether it's necessary or not. But it blocks me from a lot of potentially useful experiences. Not only is it hot in a suit of armor in August, but it's hard to hug in a suit of armor. And even if you manage to hug in a suit of armor, it's not nearly as rewarding. You know, seems like it would be real useful at some point if I was to take off the suit of armor and find out if it's necessary or not. But if I just take off the suit of armor and discover if anybody stabs me, that's pretty risky. That's going to be too scary to do. Well, how could I manage this? How about if I take off one gauntlet, walk around in the woods for a while, see what happens? You know, I'm taking a risk. I might get stabbed in the hand, but it's not a life and death risk. It's a risk that I might be able to take. It might not be too scary. And if that turns out okay, maybe I could take off the other gauntlet, walk around. Maybe I could, and in a series of manageable steps, I can test out whether this armor is really necessary without taking any intolerable risks in the process. How's that sound to them? How would this apply in real life if we're talking about the ways in which I avoid intimacy, avoid closeness, avoid letting people really get to know me? And it's going to take a little time to think through the details and plan how to do it in manageable steps. But if I want to get comfortable with intimacy, I'm going to need to gradually risk intimacy and tolerate the anxiety long enough to discover if this is a good or bad idea. How's all that sound? A lot of people who had a history of sexual abuse have a real hard time being assertive, setting limits, so on. And, you know, sometimes they've been directly taught that it's not okay to say no, it's not okay to set limits. You know, and it may need to understand the details of that and help them think through, wait a minute, does this really hold water? Sometimes if this stuff happened when they were a little kid and I need to help them process they're not a little kid anymore, yeah. When you were 5 or 8, saying no to your parents would not have been a winning proposition. You're not a little kid anymore. It's now legit to say no. And also may need to help the person, you know, learn how to say no effectively and practice saying no effectively. And think through what to do if this person's not taking no for an answer. A lot of people with a history of sexual abuse, this results in discomfort with sexuality and various sexual issues. Eminently treatable stuff. However, if you don't have any training in sex therapy, this might be a time to help them connect with somebody who knows how to do sex therapy rather than trying to reinvent sex therapy on your own. You know, particularly the more it gets into specific sexual dysfunction, inhibited sexual desire, etc. You know, unless you're really out in the boonies, the odds are there's somebody in your community who knows how to do sex therapy and probably, you know, I actually know how to do sex therapy and have plenty of background, but it's not quick and easy to learn how to do sex therapy as a whole specialty area. Now, if you're out in the boonies and nobody else knows how to do sex therapy, it's perfectly legit to get some training and learn how to do it. Often, as we talk about this stuff, people focus on the, all the verbal interventions and slip into thinking of CBT as just talking in the office. Hopefully, you remember, A, we also want the person to be doing lots of useful stuff between sessions. But B, talking in words is not the only line of intervention we've got. And purely verbal interventions may well not access memories and emotions all as powerfully as would be desirable. And so it can be real useful to include experiential interventions, role play, and imagery as part of the package, too, because those often are more emotionally evocative and have more impact than just abstract intellectual discussions. What we've got on page 8 in the handouts is a summary of an approach by Vern Smucker about using imaginal exposure and imagery rescripting in treating childhood sexual abuse. And it's pretty self-explanatory, but the idea, A, if we help the person vividly imagine the experience, this elicits feelings pretty strongly, and we want to do this in manageable steps and not freak the person out, and do it collaboratively, make sure they're ready, you know, rather than rushing into it. But also, one of the options we've got is we can work on modifying the images. And what he does, and which can be real valuable, is first of all, the person imagines the experience they went through and tolerates the feelings. That's useful. But then they can imagine themselves as an adult intervening in the situation, driving off the perpetrator, comforting themselves as a kid, saying to themselves the things that would have been good to hear from a caring person at the time, etc. And sounds real good. You know, it's worked well for me with some of my clients. And it's a good example of how CBT doesn't have to be dry and abstract and intellectual, and that we can get more mileage out of CBT if we, you know, pay attention to emotionally powerful interventions as well as abstract intellectual interventions. Yeah?
What is that intervention? I just missed it.
Yes, on page 8 in the handouts, it's imagery rescripting.
Is this the therapist guiding the client as if client is an adult and the child is someone else's, and adult now client?
No, the child is the client as a child, and the adult is the client as an adult. So we're not doing an objectively realistic imagery exercise, mm-hmm. You know. But basically, we're helping the person as an adult comfort themselves as a child, protect themselves as a child, talk sense to themselves as a child, mm-hmm. Which is a different way of packaging rational responses.
Because
yeah.
he is instructing the client and describe it as if it's happening now.
Yes. Because part of what we're going for is emotional impact. So imagine yourself in the situation as it happening now.
So client will have to go back and forth as a child and adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
That's a lot like hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
The healing part.
Yeah.
The child.
And mm-hmm. Yeah. And, hypnosis can, one of the cool things about CBT is we steal all sorts of interventions from all sorts of places. There's a decent literature on using hypnosis within CBT. You know, we could do a hypnotic induction and have the person imagine this, and this would be much more like the way, you know, this sort of thing would be done by a hypnotist. We can also do exactly the same thing without a hypnotic induction. And the jury is out as to whether doing the hypnotic induction adds a lot for the average person or not. My reading on the literature, the last it looks at it, is it looks to me like for a lot of people, doing a hypnotic induction doesn't actually add a whole lot over, you know, imagining the situation. But it also, you know, I can buy that there are some people for whom doing the hypnotic induction really increases the impact. And I don't do hypnosis myself, so I don't have a whole lot of first-hand experience on that. But a lot of the things that, you know, hypnotists do with hypnotic inductions, we do without hypnotic inductions, and it works just fine. Also, I gave a talk down at Cleveland Clinic years ago. I forget what I was talking on, but one of the other speakers was a local hypnotist from the Akron area talking about using hypnosis for smoking cessation. And then at break, he was out there smoking like a chimney. Okay. You know, I'm not sure about the ethics of charging people for something that doesn't work for me, but just because it doesn't work for him doesn't mean it doesn't work for his clients, I guess.
One of the impact you did talk about is that I noticed clients with a history of sexual abuse when they're young, they also tend to kind of depersonalize that.
Mm-hmm.
And are there, can you talk about that
yeah.
a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, depersonalization is something that's real useful to know about. And a lot of people in the sexual abuse field focus on this person was sexually abused, they depersonalized. It must be that sexual abuse causes people to depersonalize. And a lot of people in the sexual abuse field argue that people depersonalize as a defense against the memories and feelings of sexual abuse. I'm actually inclined to think they're wrong about that. First of all, take your standard, ordinary college students and survey them about experiences of depersonalization. It turns out that in a pool of college students, about 72% of them have experienced depersonalization within the past year. And that's a lot higher than the percentage of them that have any history of sexual abuse. That actually depersonalization is a common experience that occurs with a whole variety of different problems, not just sexual abuse. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with sexual abuse. For example, it's common, one of many common side effects of anxiety, and a great many people who've been sexually abused are anxious when they come in to see us. But there are also lots of other people who are anxious for other reasons, and they also experience depersonalization. Now, that doesn't tell us what the heck is going on with depersonalization and how you deal with it. So the short answer, what the heck is going on with depersonalization? Why do people sometimes feel unreal, you know, or feel like they're cut off from everything else, or feel numb, or all the different flavors of depersonalization.
Or detachment also.
Yeah, detachment, or sometimes it feels like everything's much larger than it should be, or much smaller than it should be. There's all sorts of variations on it. Basically, it turns out that our sense of reality, our brain's sense of reality, is not built in. It's constructed from moment to moment based on, you know, are taking in all the stimuli around us. You know, you're hearing the sound of my voice, you're feeling the warmth of the room, you're feeling your chair against your butt, etc. And this gives your brain a sense of what's real and what isn't real. No problem with that, that's the way people work. However, we've got limited brain space. And if I focus on one thing, I'm not processing other stuff. Suppose I get very focused on what's going on within me. Then I'm not paying attention to the sound of the voices around me and the warmth of the room and the chair against my butt and so on. And it turns out that what happens is my sense of reality starts getting vague pretty quickly. And this happens in a variety of different situations. Suppose I have a medical emergency, my heart has stopped, the EMTs are there trying to keep me alive. What is my attention to be focused on? I'm not going to be focused on the room around me. I'm not going to be focused on what people are saying. I'm going to be focused on what's going on with my body. And what happens to people? They have out-of-body experiences. They experience themselves floating up by the ceiling, looking down at their body. They focus on a tunnel of white, and I'm moving towards the light, and so on. And people draw all sorts of conclusions about this, what this tells us about life after death, and so on. And they don't process that exactly the same experiences occur in situations where people aren't dying, that this is a side effect of self-focused attention. The bad news is it doesn't tell us anything about life after death. It tells us what happens when my attention gets very focused on what's going on with my body. Or let's imagine a stage fright situation. I'm up on stage. I'm, concerned about how anxious I'm feeling, and will people notice I'm anxious, and will I say something dumb, and do I look weird, and so on. And I get very focused within myself, and all of a sudden I'm feeling awful damn weird, which freaks me out even more because then I'm afraid that that will show to people. Or I'm on a first date, and I'm afraid I'll use the wrong fork, etc. Basically, in any situation where we get strongly self-focused attention, I'm not tuned into the world around me nearly as much as I normally would be, and things can start feeling weird pretty quickly, and it's just a side effect of self-focused attention. There's nothing abnormal about it. It's got nothing specifically to do with trauma. It's not dangerous. It does freak people out because they don't know what's happening and they don't know if it's dangerous, and I'll be, oh my God, I must be going crazy. Oh my God, I must be losing control. And actually, you can get something very much like panic disorder. You'll find it in DSM under depersonalization disorder. If I have one episode of depersonalization and it freaks me out, then I may go through life, gee, is it going to happen again? I'm paying attention to how I feel. I pay attention to what's going on within me. Wait a minute, I'm getting self-focused. And now the more I do that, the more I feel weird. The more I feel weird, the more I focus within. And voila, I'm experiencing depersonalization again. This really freaks me out. I'm even more on the lookout. And so the person ends up having repeated episodes of depersonalization because of the side effects of their vigilance and anxiety. How do we deal with it? Well, it's got a lot in common with dealing with panic attacks. The big part of what freaks them out and keeps it going is the person doesn't know what's going on, and it seems to them it must be dangerous in some way. And so, helping the person understand that this is a weird experience that happens to people when the conditions are right doesn't mean anything's wrong with them. In fact, it means their brain is functioning exactly the way it's designed to function. One could question whether this is an intelligent design or not, because it can be obnoxious, but it's not dangerous. It's not a sign of craziness. It doesn't mean anything. It's just one of those weird experiences people have. And what do I need to do about it? Well, actually, the short answer is I don't need to do anything. One option for dealing with it is I could simply put up with it, and it will eventually pass. And the less I'm scared of it, the less I'm going to be focused on all my sensations, and so it'll pass more quickly. And if I simply tolerate it and discover that it feels weird for a while, it passes, nothing terrible comes of it, I'll be less and less scared of it. It'll be less and less of a problem. It's highly likely to fade away. It'll still reoccur whenever I get very self-focused. For most people, simply having an explanation, knowing it's not dangerous, knowing that putting up with it is a perfectly fine option. For most people, that works fine as a solution. And that's the intervention I use most commonly. Probably 80-85% of the time, that's all that's needed. Some people are so freaked out by it that that sort of light level of intervention is not enough. Hey, what we got here is we're dealing with anxiety, fear. Sounds like maybe the person needs to face what they fear in manageable steps. If I fear, feeling weird, feeling out of it, depersonalization, how can I face that in manageable steps? One option is, if there are certain situations in daily life that trigger this, I could choose to go face those situations in order to experience depersonalization and put up with it and have it sink in that this is just a weird experience, I don't need to be afraid of it. Perfectly fine option, works well. Or we could come up with a way for the person to intentionally induce the experience so that they can tolerate it and get less freaked out about it. Remember the video Bart played when she was talking about panic and agoraphobia, where Chris had the client intentionally hyperventilating so she can tolerate the sensations that go along with hyperventilation. Works great. How could I induce a feeling of depersonalization so that I can tolerate it? Well, you know, find a convenient mirror, go up to the mirror, stare into your own eyes for a few minutes, and notice how you feel. For most people, simply staring into your own eyes in a mirror for a few minutes works great as a way to induce depersonalization. And if the client's doing it voluntarily in order to induce the sensations, that makes it pretty clear. This is not something terrible happening to me. This is not an emergency. This is something I'm doing. It feels weird, but it's not dangerous. And it can be real useful. And they may need a number of repetitions, but it's real useful in getting less and less afraid of the sensations. Now, also, you know, all the people with control issues, you know, one thing that freaks them out by depersonalization is, there's nothing I can do. Well, actually, there is stuff they can do. And another option we've got is teaching the person some coping techniques. And if depersonalization is a product of self-focused attention, you know, inward-focused attention, what might be useful to do? Suppose I intentionally focus outwards. Suppose I'm feeling weird and unreal and all sorts of spooky feelings, and I intentionally stop and pay attention to the sound of my therapist's voice, pay attention to the feel of the chair against my back, pay attention to the warmth of the room, look at the gray in his beard, etc. Most of the time, just a few minutes of outward focus has a person feeling less and less weird and more ordinary. You know, I tend to use that line of intervention last because, like with any coping technique, you know, there's the risk of the person using it as a way to escape the sensation, which is counterproductive. We want the person to use it as a way to tone things down so they can face the sensation. And there's some subtlety in getting that message across to the client and getting them to retain it. So the vast majority of the time, I deal with depersonalization without teaching outward focus because it's simpler and less work. You know, for the people who really need to have something they can do, teaching them outward focus is a fine option. And it works well.
So what I'm hearing, combination of technique depending on what are the issues interfering, and you explore that through guided discovery.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the traditional idea that depersonalization is something that a person uses to defend against the memories and feelings, with my clients, that usually turns out not to be the case. It usually turns out to just be a side effect of self-focused attention. Now, certainly, it's something that a person could learn to use as a defense. You know, if I want to intentionally depersonalize, I can learn how to do that. All I need to do is focus my attention inward. There are a variety of meditative techniques you can use to do that if you want to. But for most people, it's just the freedom of self. You know, on their own, they learn that if they focus their attention on certain ways, they zone out. And if somebody is using this zoning out defensively, then we can help them look at the pros and cons of zoning out defensively, the pros and cons of facing the memories and feelings in manageable steps. And we help them discover that zoning out's got drawbacks and facing one's feelings and memories and manageable steps is not such a bad idea after all. And that works just fine. But actually, I find that usually the idea that people are using this defensively is just not true. Usually, it's just a symptom that the person's freaking out about. How's all that sound? at this point, let's take a 10-minute break, and I'll have a few comments, and then we'll have some consultation time. So start thinking about whether you have any cases you'd like input on, completely optional as to whether it has anything to do with sexual abuse or anger. You know, everything is fair game.